Welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Fred Chaney is Senior Australian of the Year and an activist on Indigenous affairs. He was a former Minister for Aboriginal Affairs in the Fraser government, and he joins us today. Fred Chaney, one of Tony Abbott's core promises was for a referendum to recognise Indigenous Australians in the Constitution. Do you think the currently bitter general political climate will set back that specific cause?
Look, I think political discord is unhelpful to any referendum proposal. We know, I mean, it's notorious that it's difficult to get a constitutional amendment up. I think that if people are really worried about other aspects of politics, of economics and things generally, I think they're less likely to look favourably on something which is perhaps peripheral to their core interests. So my preference would be to find a time of political calm and, yes, and government popularity and continued cross-party support to bring this forward.
That might be a bit of a long wait as things look now. Are we looking at this term, do you think, or a next term?
Well, I think that requires you to predict how the political scene pans out over that period. I mean, you've got work to be done by Parliament itself at the moment, and that committee which is chaired by, deputy chaired by Aboriginal Members of Parliament, Ken Wyatt and Senator Nova Pyrrhus, have got some real work to do on formulation. I doubt the Attorney-General's working on this as well. And so there's still work to be done on the proposition and whether you can satisfy what I think are the two key constituents here, which are the Aboriginal people, Aboriginal and Islander people themselves, because if they don't like it, I don't think the rest of Australia will think it's worth supporting. And then you've got what I'd call the more conservative constitutionalists who don't want to see a shift in power away from Parliament towards the High Court. So I think they're the sort of issues of substance that no doubt Parliament is grappling with. And I think the timing will also be very dependent on just what proposition is being put forward.
Now, you come from Western Australia. What do you think feeling is like there?
Well, look, on my good days, I feel pretty happy about where Australia's at in terms of Indigenous affairs. I'm painfully aware of the remaining and very large problems. I mean, in my state, we jail people at a rate which is terrifying. There are serious issues about child protection and child removal. So one should never be too relaxed about this. But on the other hand, it's a different country from when I was minister all that time ago, because you've got the West Australian government negotiating a land settlement over the southwest. You've got a whole lot of agreements being made in the Pilbara. You've got a tremendous number of companies and individuals and institutions who are getting into reconciliation action plans. And that's why I said at the beginning of the year, when I got this Senior Australian of the Year award, that it was the most hopeful period of my life, because there are more things lined up to help than ever before in my lifetime. So all that's very positive. And every day, I would say, someone contacts me about the things they're doing and want to do, and that's Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. And there's a massive activity that's really remarkable. And I go back to Australia Day, and you know, you've got an Australian of the Year who's an Aboriginal sportsman, and I thought, well, gosh, you know, that's terrific, because I think Adam Goods is a great person. But then the Australian came out with their competing Australians of the Year, and they had five people, four of them Aboriginals. And in a funny sort of way, I think that tells you something about the mood of the nation at the moment, and that's very positive.
And that could be positive for the referendum, you think?
Look, I think that as long as politics don't get in the way, which is perhaps a silly thing to say, but, you know, if the thing is not very contentious and comes forward in a reasonably calm atmosphere, I think there's a real will in the Australian community to see things improved. And I think if they see this constitutional recognition as being part of keeping the movement forward, then I think it'll get very good support.
Now, just talking more generally, what sort of progress do you think we're making on closing the gap of disadvantage?
Well, I mean, we've got the required statements by prime ministers about closing the gap. So there's plenty of statistical evidence about a rate of progress, which I think everyone would say is slower than we want. In some cases, there's some slipping back for a complex of reasons. Life expectancy, for example, I think hasn't improved because the life expectancy of non-Aboriginal Australians has gone up. So it isn't that Aboriginal people have gone backwards and they've perhaps come up a bit, but the rest of the population's come up even more. So there are similar, I think, complications in the employment field. But in my view, again, if you look at look beyond the community engagement, which is very large, and look at government engagement, we're at a time of extraordinary opportunity, and I stress the word opportunity rather than achievement so far, but you've got the Prime Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, a Minister in Cabinet, a Parliamentary Secretary. So you've got a big focus of political strength, I suppose, on the subject. And then you've got all these public servants who are involved in programs being taken into Prime Minister and Cabinet. Now, I'm sure administrative experts would say, well, you know, that might be administratively a rather cumbersome thing to do and a difficult thing for PM&C to handle. But I think what that indicates is an absolute determination to drive change, because there are only two departments of state that can drive whole of government change, and that's PM&C and Treasury. And so I take that as a further indication of absolute intention on the part of the man who's dubbed himself the Prime Minister for Aboriginal Affairs. Now, the big question in my mind, and what I'm really focused on at the moment, is how do you turn those, you know, that focus and the really interesting developments post-budget, with the taking of 150 programs into PM&C and then saying we're going to reduce them over the next 12 months into five streams of programs to permit more regional, flexible, you know, approaches. I think that's all in the right direction, and it gives me a great sense of hope. But then on the other hand, that's going to require amazing administrative effort. You think of it. In this great diversity of circumstances, 150 programs are going to be, over the next 12 months, dealt with by public servants, working hopefully with the Aboriginal communities involved, and put into a whole different framework. Now, I think that's an enormous task, and the big question is the skill set there to do it, and are the accountabilities and the directions and the instructions being given to public servants the sort of instructions and accountabilities that will lead to changes of behaviour? And finally, I'd say, are there measures being taken to skill up the public service to have the sort of skills which are more readily available in the private sector? For example, I find working with mining companies on Aboriginal issues pretty rewarding because they take a project management approach. What's the objective? Well, it's to have kids finish year 12. What do we need to do? How do we bring all the relevant factors together? And there's not a sort of rigid departmental approach. Instead, there's a managerial approach which says we know what the objective is and we manage as many of the factors as possible to achieve it. Somehow, I think the new system that the government's putting in place requires that same approach, that same set of skills, and that's not the culture in which most public servants have been brought up.
What about the budget's finances? Has Aboriginal Affairs been hit too much?
Look, I haven't been able to do a sort of forensic examination of that. What I do know is that if you need to bring a budget back into balance, and my personal view on that is that yes, you do, that the changes which are made will never be all perfect. Inevitably, they're made with a saw or an axe rather than a scalpel, so there'll be some jagged edges, and I would be very surprised if, given the fact that I think there's some $300 million cut out of the budget, there'll be some rough corners there, and I hope they'll be looked at very carefully and sympathetically and fixed where possible. But I actually think the government's right in wanting to move to a much more flexible, managed, pooled funding type approach with regional approaches rather than national approaches. I think that's absolutely correct. It's in line with the work we did at Desert Knowledge Australia in our remote focus project. If you want this to work, you have to have government working in a quite different way. And so the question is the broad idea right? Yes. Is the execution of the idea going to be right? Well, I hope so, and that's what I think we need to keep a close watch on.
Now, you've spoken about the bureaucratic level and the program level, but what about on the ground? For example, do you think that the efforts to enforce school attendance will work?
Again, I mean, I think the local circumstances vary enormously from community to community. I think school attendance is vital. Unsurprisingly, I think work done in the past says that the factor which most closely correlates with educational outcomes is school attendance, which seems to be something you wouldn't have needed to research, actually. But of course, it's a more complex thing. What is the attitude of the kids to school? What is the attitude of the school to the children? What are the programs? Are they right for the children who are at a particular stage of development? What's the health issues that are related? If every two-thirds of the kids in the class have got otitis media, then, you know, they can't hear. So, I mean, I think, of course, it's right to want kids at school. And in my view, the single thing that will change these things forever would be if we could ensure that every Aboriginal child was fully educated in to his or her capacity in the dominant culture. I want to see Aboriginal people with bicultural capacity, because all of the successful Aboriginal people who I work with and meet and admire are confident in both cultures, and I think that's, you know, that doesn't come without education. So the government's right to have a focus on education. Attendance is a starting point, but if the schools, and they'll be mainly state schools which the kids are attending, if the schools aren't ready for the kids, can't cope with them, can't educate them, then of course you've got a whole other set of things to deal with. And that's why this regional approach is important. Noel Pearson said, he said a lot of wise things over the years, but one of the things he said that really struck me years ago was, when you go into a community, it's really important to know the order in which you need to do things. If, for example, there's massive violence in a community, then there's no point in saying we're going to give emphasis to education. You've got to actually deal with that first. And I suppose my own experience of working with remote communities is that they are diverse, and knowing what's the right thing to do next and doing things in a logical order that carries things forward is something that can't be done by central direction. And so, yes, school attendance is really important. I know the current minister is really putting huge emphasis on it, in line with the Prime Minister, and he's physically visiting communities and encouraging that. But I think he would be as worried as I am that are the complementary things, the relevant things around that, going to be available? And that's, again, the jury's out.
And there's also the whole challenge of giving people an attitude of hope, isn't there? That it's very easy in these communities, when life is so tough, to get into this circle and cycle of disadvantage or not be able to get out of it.
Look, again, there are a lot of factors. I mean, most of these communities have had a succession of seagulls, that is, people like me who fly in, and they say, fly in, shit, and fly out again, you know. I mean, a succession of public servants, politicians, ministers come in and they have the same conversations, and as they say very plaintively, and I've said, why do we have to say all this again? You know, you wrote it down last time, or somebody wrote it down. Surely you've got it in a book somewhere. So there's that, there's a sort of reform fatigue, if you like, and disillusion about the fact that governments in the past have often not delivered on their promises. But then, and again, this is the subtlety of it. David Ross, who's to me, an admirable Aboriginal leader from the Central Land Council, said to me once, Fred, one of the difficulties some of our people have with education is they don't want their children to stop being Aboriginals.
That's a real dilemma, isn't it?
No, I think that's why I say I think this is a significant thing now.
And they don't want them to go away, are they?
And I know, that's right, and that's why the work we do in the little foundation I'm part of, the Polly Farmer, we educate in local state schools. And I'll give you a very specific example of that. In Tom Price, which had never graduated an Aboriginal child in year 12, we got one the first one we felt so good about. The next year we got seven, and one got into NIDA. Now, he's now graduated from NIDA, and he's back in that community, working with that community on creative and other things. Now, that's what we should be aiming to do, I think, make these local state schools work, because that's where 90%, I don't care how many great scholarship programs you've got, and they're great programs, you'll produce more Noles and more Pats and more Mix, but we need to produce a lot of working people who can live and work in their communities and so on. So, again, look, simplistic nostrums should be avoided here. The only thing that works is steady, long-term, 20-year horizons, and that's the lovely thing about working with mining companies. You can talk to them about the next 20 years. You've got to accept that change will be gradual and it needs to be locally managed, locally controlled, and the people who have to have absolute engagement and involvement in it are the Aboriginal people themselves. Proven, I could quote chapter and verse about that, signed off by Gary Banks. What works is the sort of thing I've described.
Can I turn to a different topic altogether now? The government is wants to make changes to water down the Racial Discrimination Act. How important has that act been to the Aboriginal community?
It's been absolutely vital, because quite apart from the issue, which is the issue of the moment, about racial vilification, of course, there probably wouldn't have been a Mabo case without the Racial Discrimination Act. I mean, it's important to remember there have been a lot of really wonderful moments in this journey that Australia's taken. And one of them was 1975, when we unanimously supported the Racial Discrimination Act. It's part of history which is perhaps the less known part of the Mabo history, that the Bjelke-Petersen government legislated to try to undermine that case and to remove its legal basis. And the High Court struck down that attempt, that legislation, as being in breach of the Racial Discrimination Act. In exactly the same way when a Liberal government in Western Australia, led by Richard Court, who I might say has got a lot of Aboriginal admirers and friends, I'm not having a go at Richard here at all, but Richard tried to substitute a form of statutory title for native title, and again that was struck down by the High Court as a breach of the Racial Discrimination Act. Now, in my view, the most important thing that's happened for Aboriginal and Islander people in my lifetime has been the Mabo case, because it's moved them from it's moved the power balance between them and the settler society. It has enabled them to come to the table not as supplicants but as stakeholders. And I mean, to see in my state of Western Australia a Conservative government negotiating a land settlement across the southwest of Western Australia, to see the great mining houses working with Aboriginal people and making very substantial agreements with them, not as individual Australians, the state government's not saying there are 37 Noongars, we're making an agreement with 37,000 Noongars, I'm sorry. We're not making it with them as individuals. We are making this agreement with them, or seeking to make it with them, as members of their Aboriginal polities, as members of their tribal groups. Now, that's a fantastic step forward, and I think is a really amazing shift in favour of Aboriginal people. And although a lot of Aboriginal people will say quite correctly, native title's very inconsistent in its application, that some miss out, all that stuff, it is the thing that has shifted the power balance, and I think it's made a huge difference to the standing of Aboriginal people and their capacity to be at the table.
Now, the push to change Section 18C of the Act, of course, came because of Andrew Bolt's case, which he lost after he wrote disparagingly about a group of Aboriginal people. What do you think of this push to change the Act?
Look, I've had to confess to a couple of audiences lately that I'm not across the real detail of this argument, and I should be cautious, but I know on which side of the argument I would err, and I would err on the side of really making it absolutely clear by statute that racial vilification and abuse is not on. I don't think that, you know, I haven't made much public comment on that for the reason I haven't had time to study the detail enough, but I was asked for comment, and what I said was that I would be taking much more notice of the people who suffer the vilification, and I'd include the Jewish community in that, by the way,
who've been very outspoken.
I'd pay more attention than to people like me, white lawyers, all white lawyers, because, you know, I've been bullied as a child by my school. I've had the odd bit of abuse as a politician, but I am under no illusions that Aboriginal people, and indeed some other minorities, including still gay people, are absolutely regularly abused. The really great thing that Adam Goods has done, by the way, as Australian of the Year and as a football star and as a celebrity in that regard, is to reopen the discussion on racism in Australia. Now, there'd been an embarrassed sort of, no, resentful silence came down over that discussion. I think racism is one of the, if you want to destroy someone's life, put them down in a racial way. And I think I think too many Aboriginal people run into this. It lowers their sense of self-worth. It lowers their sense of what is possible. And I think it's dreadful, and I want to see it removed. And so if I'm going to make a mistake, I'm going to make a mistake along the lines of protecting people from that sort of, I want to use a really bad word there, from that sort of, you know, disgraceful behaviour.
So do you think the government really should back off this whole exercise, just leave the legislation as it is?
Look, again, I mean, I should be cautious, not having looked at all the detail, but I think it's interesting that that survey, I saw the survey was published where nearly as many people as voted yes in the referendum in 1967 said they didn't think this was a great idea. And I noticed in the media, I think probably only today, that there's an indication that the thing is not proceeding at this time and they're reconsidering it. I think that, well, they say bad cases, or hard cases make bad law. I think to knock off something that's been around for 20 years and which I think has been pretty useful because of one case that people got upset about is probably a mistake.
So just leave it.
If I had to make a judgment, and if my judgment mattered in this thing, yeah, I think I'd leave it.
Now, we're talking here in Parliament House. You left Parliament two decades ago. You left Parliament 2 decades ago. Do you think the Parliament itself and politics generally has changed in that time?
I think it's probably harder than it was. I mean, politics got pretty hard in 1975, as you'll remember.
Indeed.
And indeed, you know, I mean, I like to claim John Button as a friend, and was until his death, and I'm still on the John Button Foundation board, which I'm very good at. I'm now giving the John Button lecture this year. So, I mean, I had friendships across party lines, but I do remember that our friendship was very strained after 1975. So, you know, one should be careful about imagining that it was all lovely in the past. And I think we hunted the Whitlam government pretty comprehensively over that 1975 period. And but I think that I think it's harder to have a sensible conversation about policy than it was. I think that parliamentary committees find it harder to look at things in a non-partisan way. I mean, to go back to 75 and give an example, I was on the Constitutional Legal Affairs Committee with Button and Grimes, I think, and another Labor member who went on to be a judge, Misson on our side, and I forget who else, maybe. We looked at the Great National Compensation Scheme, and in the end we came to a unanimous view on it. And, you know, there was the same with the Family Law Act. You know, I think the parliamentary committee system worked differently in a less party-bound way. And I think that, I suppose one of the things I don't like about the public, some of the public debate now, is that the absolute put-down, the contempt that you show for people of a different view. I've got a wife who's been quite active in trying to help refugees. And I really think she and the people that she worked with are fantastic people. And I really respect them and I love the work they do, and I've become very friendly with some refugees as a result. And that's been a rich addition to our life. And then I read journalists who talk as though people like my wife are some sort of vermin or scum or, you know, to be despised. And I find that really sad, actually. I mean, I mentioned refugees. There's no more vexed public policy issue than that, more difficult for governments and oppositions to handle. And this is not a broadcast about that. But you can't have a civil, quiet discussion. I think if we're ever to get to a better space on refugees, probably the lead will have to come from outside the parliament, because I don't think the political situation permits what I would call a principled, rational discussion which sees that this is just a tiny part of a huge world problem and where do we fit.
Why do you think there's been this decline in tone, decline in the ability to reach out and get any sort of consensus on policy?
I think the insecure base of the parties is, that is, the insecure intellectual base. I mean, in a way, the coming together on sort of opening up the Australian economy, the putting aside of the socialist alternative, if you like, has left the Labor Party in a really strange position. I mean, what do they actually believe? And I talk occasionally to Labor people, and I must say, I find it pretty hard to know what they believe, what the basis is. Now, what do Liberals believe? Well, a lot of people would say that traditionally the Liberals were defined by being anti-Labor. And there was a bit of truth in that, because it did contain the broad church that Howard talked about, and I was part of that broad church. I realised I lived in the party in Western Australia with some very conservative people, some of whom, by the way, gave me fantastic support, which was an illustration of the broad church at work. I mean, oddly enough, some of my strongest support in Western Australia in the Liberal Party came from pastoralists, and yet they thought a lot of my thinking on Aboriginal matters was crazy. So, but there was that sense of engagement and tolerance and so on. And I think that's quality that's being lost, and I think that's a shame, because I think the big issues for Australia are quite problematic. And to take just another economic, take tax. We have no effective taxes on capital, basically. And, you know, how do you sensibly look at the structure of your society and at the fact that some people are immensely wealthy and other people are struggling? And in America, the hollowing out of what they call the middle class, we would call the working class, actually, the blue-collar class, jobs disappearing, blah, 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 you know, really big stuff. Can we have a rational discussion on the almost total lack of taxes on capital, on wealth, the lack of a broadly, really properly broadly based consumption tax, the need to have low income taxes to encourage effort? I mean, the whole, I don't know that the political system is capable of having a rational discussion on this, because it quickly says, look, here's a point where we can really score and scare hell out of the electorate. I remember we nearly won the 84 election against Hawke. I mean, Hawke made, like all new governments do, a lot of mistakes in his first year. And I think it was Andrew Peacock campaigning because they were looking at an assets test. And remember, part of this, Andrew Peacock. I'm the assets man inspector. So, I mean, let's not pretend there weren't scare campaigns in the past. Of course there were, but I think we had a better capacity for civil discourse, and that's what maybe more of those conversations have to take place outside of politics until you build up a public sense that's so strong that that the politicians feel safe. You know, there is actually a good... I'm being very lengthy here, I know. I think the disputes, the debate between the wets and the dries in the 70s and 80s in the Liberal Party were central to the success of the Hawke government. Those debates were very divisive in the Liberal Party, but they were genuine discussions about people who believe passionately in things. So you've got Jim Carlton, Peter Shack, etc., John Hyde on one side, and you've got Ian McPhee and others on the other side, but there was a genuine stretching of the mind, and eventually by 83, I think there was a strong sense of a core conviction in the Liberal Party post our loss of government that opening up the economy, making sure we didn't go down the Argentinian road, had become the thing we had to do. Now, Hawke, to everyone's surprise, and I think with a high level of political leadership and brilliance, actually, provided that opportunity. And in the end, I don't think you could say we blocked any significant reform, which had cost us politically, I think. But it was a case where the ideas had come into good currency to a point where they could be carried forward at the political level. So I think that's what we need to try and do about these real problems the present government's got on the fiscal front. These aren't artificial problems, they are real problems, and let's have a rational discussion about how they should be dealt with.
Fred Chaney, it's been great talking with you again, and that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast today. I'm Michelle Grattan. We'll be back with another broadcast soon.